This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McCray.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Tracy, nice to see you.
It's good to be here.
I was just thinking about today's topic, and you are probably not old enough to remember that the infections used to kill more people than any other disease, more people than heart disease in the United States. You don't remember that, do you?
I don't. Well, I'm happy to say I don't, yes.
Fortunately, you were not around when we had things like smallpox and measles and yellow fever and polio and influenza that took hundreds of thousands of lives. Now, I remember as a kid that polio was a bad feared disease. And there were days when there was a case of polio in our town and you couldn't go to the swimming pool. They closed the swimming pool until they put enough chlorine in there to kill all the polio germs. And then along came the Salk and the Sabin vaccine, and virtually polio has been wiped out in the United States. Hmm. Not around the world completely, but at least in the United States. But despite all that, we're really not out of the woods when it comes to infections. Today, you know, we have to worry about Ebola. There's a new enterovirus out there called enterovirus 68 that seems to be affecting a fair number of children around the country.
Yeah, just this week we started hearing about that one.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, we've always got the problem of resistant bugs that seem to be outsmarting our best antibiotics.
That was a step ahead.
Yeah, infections and antibiotics, things that we really need to know something about.
Well, you are in luck because today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we're going to meet infectious disease specialist Dr. Pratish Tosh from Mayo Clinic Rochester. We'll get an update on the Ebola virus and find out what the chances are that it will hit this country. We'll talk about the recent enterovirus outbreak affecting more and more children in the United States, and we'll ask him how likely it is that the world will experience at some time a pandemic, a worldwide epidemic caused by some sort of infectious agent.
So we're going to get all of our questions answered about infectious diseases.
Yes, and we got to talk about washing hands, too.
Is that a big deal?
That's right.
Well, it seems to be. You know, first, I want to talk about something that came out of Apple Incorporated this week. Ooh. Lots of new product announcements, and one of those is called a health kit system, and it was developed in conjunction with the Mayo Clinic, and it is going to allow users to monitor several different health parameters and share those with their doctors or their clinic. Joining us by telephone, the Medical Director of Marketing for Mayo Clinic Rochester, Dr. John Wald. Dr. Wald, good morning. Thanks so much for being with us.
Morning, Tom. Morning, Tracy. How are you this morning?
Well, we're good. Thank you. So tell us about the health and wellness features of the new iWatch that's supposed to be coming out, I think, early 2015.
That is correct. And what we heard released this week was more about the wellness aspects of the iWatch as opposed to the health aspects of the iWatch, if you will, what we would in medicine consider clinical care. It was really more about exercise monitoring and wellness monitoring than it was about monitoring parameters related to clinical outcomes, if you will.
So what would it measure? What will it measure that might help someone improve their health?
What it really is going to be measuring is the various parameters of exercise, similar to other Fitbit-like devices, how far you walk, how far you run. It has the ability, based on a pressure sensor, to even say how many steps or what elevations you've climbed so that you can monitor the number of steps that you've walked in the day or the change in altitude that you've walked during the day. And those parameters will be able to be eventually transferred into the application called HealthKit.
When Apple releases some new device, you know, everyone is so excited. And aside from the techie type of people who are just love what gadgets can do for them, what are the real health impacts of a device like this?
I think we've yet to see, Tracy, what those true health impacts will be. I believe that this is just the first generation of remote monitoring capabilities that we'll see come down the pike in the next 3 to 5 years. And I believe that it's the next generation as we start to move beyond exercise and start to look at parameters, whether that be your heart rate or your respiratory rate, your blood pressure, which will really start to affect our ability to interact with patients. Now, on the wellness side, the ability to monitor exercise is a good thing because obesity is a significant issue around the world. And the more we can get people aware of the amount of the exercise they're completing and the number of calories they're taking in, those will be all very good things to move forward in the wellness of our country and around the world.
You know, one of the concerns is that as an individual, someone has the potential to look at all of this data and know what you're measuring and know more about you than you might want them to. What about privacy issues? And is all this data going to be secure?
Well, Tom, as you know, we've built our reputation at the Mayo Clinic for 150 years on being a very trusted health partner, and it was one of the things that we considered in this relationship with Apple. The information that's collected, whether it moves from an electronic medical record in a health establishment into HealthKit through some form of intermediate app, or it's downloaded from the patient into the HealthKit app, will be in the domain of the patient or in the consumer themselves, and that information will truly be housed within whatever device the HealthKit app is on. So it will be as secure as your phone is secure. And that information, just like a hand copy or paper copy of that information, will be the responsibility of the patient. Patients and consumers will have the opportunity to store this information in the iCloud. If they do that, that information is then available in the cloud and is secure in the cloud, but we all must be very vigilant about how we protect our passwords and login information because, as you know, there was a lot of information last 2 weeks about certain celebrities in Hollywood who had their information, their login information and passwords taken.
Well, you know, it's all very exciting, Dr. Wald. Congratulations on this relationship with Apple. We're all looking forward to it. And is it correct that the iWatch will presumably be available after the first of the year?
That is correct. We heard first quarter of 2015 at the release this week.
All right. A lot of people can't wait.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, not if it could have only been for Christmas.
gift certificate.
Gift certificates. All right. Very good.
Thanks, Dr. Wald.
All right, Tom, Tracy, have a great day.
Yep, thank you.
You bet. We'll take a short break, and then coming up, we'll talk with infectious disease specialist Dr. Pratish Tosh, plus myth or matter of fact, the Ebola virus is potentially more dangerous than influenza. Mm. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for our infectious disease expert at 507-282-1234. Of course, you can tweet us at any time at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio as well. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. This week's guest, an infectious disease specialist, Dr. Pratish Tosh. Dr. Tosh, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
You know, we have talked to you on the telephone, but we've never had the good fortune of having you right here in the studio. Great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Of course. Thank you so much.
It's because he's a tough guy to track down. That's what it is. You're very busy.
Well, he's chasing bugs all day long.
That's
no wonder.
Right.
So, you mentioned just before the program, we're going to start out and talk a little bit about this enterovirus infection that's affecting so many children. But you were telling us just before the program that you used to work for the CDC.
I did. There is a program called the Epidemic Intelligence Service, which was started actually in the 1950s during the Korean War in a way to try to counteract any potential bioterrorism. And that's how it started. And this is the sort of the premier applied epidemiology training program in the world. And for example, the current CDC director was an old EIS officer back in the day, several prior surgeon generals, et cetera. And so it is a place where it's a group of people who are really focused on tracking down emerging outbreaks and shutting them down. And basically, you haven't heard of them before, heard of us. We're not some secret organization. We're just basically a bunch of nerds doing what we love.
I don't know for sure, but I think there might be a CSI spinoff of this on CBS this fall that are just tracking down outbreaks.
Well, if you see the movie Contagion,
right?
What's the Kate? Winslet, that's her.
Okay.
Plays an EIS officer in the movie. I won't give away the ending.
But that's what you did?
That's what I did. I investigated outbreaks, and that was it. It was a very informative time and a very great experience being there. And you know, there's people there who are there right now who are in Liberia at the moment working on the Ebola outbreak. And basically every outbreak that's come on since the 1950s, any major outbreak, EIS officers have been involved.
What? So if you were still there, you would probably be tracking down the people with the enterovirus, for example?
It depends which area. But the EIS officers, it's a two-year program. Following, say, if a physician does residency and fellowship, I did it after my infectious diseases fellowship. And so it's a two-year training program, and those are the ones who really go out in the field. Need some sort of young blood.
For the purposes of the discussion, what does outbreak mean?
Sure. And it really, people use the term cluster or epidemic and outbreak.
Pandemic?
And pandemic is a different term, but those first three terms are somewhat interchangeable, and it depends on what you want to portray. Basically, they mean that there is a number of infections greater than what you would expect.
Okay.
So if we are looking at something like anthrax, one infection would be an outbreak because it is more than you would expect. However, if there is, say, we have a certain number of meningitis cases that we would expect in a certain period of time, if you start to see more of those, then that would be an outbreak.
And what's a pandemic then?
A pandemic, it would be an epidemic that reaches across the world.
Okay.
A worldwide epidemic.
A worldwide epidemic.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And there's potential for that with the Ebola virus, right? What do you think?
Well, I think that's less likely for the Ebola virus, which should not take away from the amount of concern we have for what's going on in West Africa. The things I would get really concerned about for pandemics are these respiratory viruses, such as novel influenza viruses or things like the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, MERS, which came out in the springtime. And we can talk more about my thoughts on the Ebola virus.
Let's stick with the pandemic issue. Whatever happened, it seems like a few years ago we were really concerned about the swine flu, and then we were really concerned about the bird flu. And there were some alarmists who have turned out to be alarmists out there who suggested that this could turn into a pandemic. Were they? Obviously, they were wrong, but is the potential there?
So let's go back to the avian influenza, H5N1.
The bird flu.
The bird flu.
Yeah.
And so that sort of came out. And since that time, you sort of see sporadic infections. And it's really with people with very close contact with sick birds. And so since for the last decade, we've seen, maybe 1,000 deaths across the world in that time. But let's compare back to the actual pandemic that happened in 2009. Where we had a few cases that were identified in California and Mexico, and then just 2-3 days later, we had infections in Spain. And then just a few days later, within a week, this thing was across the world. And within months, we had hundreds of thousands to millions of people infected. And that is a very different time course than what we have seen with avian influenza, the bird flu.
Mm-hmm.
The things that when you hear news reports and things like that of new pathogens or new bugs, if you will, coming out. And so what concerns me about could this be a pandemic, the next pandemic? And the things I like to listen for are very key terms. One is that healthy people are dying, meaning that previously healthy people who should be able to fight off infections are suddenly getting sick, and not just sick, but requiring hospitalization, some of them actually dying. And that really suggests that this is a virulent organism, something that can infect humans and cause a lot of damage. One of the things I also listen for is it new? Is this something that humans haven't really seen before and so therefore don't have immunity to it? And so some of these bird flus, we don't really see a lot of it. And so most people do not have immunity to it. And one of the other things is really the crux here is it easily transmitted between humans? And that's somewhat tough to elucidate. But let's say the 2009 H1N1 influenza, these initial cases had nothing to do with each other. There was no common epidemiologic link. It's not like they were all handling birds or handling swine or anything like that. It really came out of nowhere. They had nothing to do with each other, didn't see each other. And so that really gives the suggestion that it's being passed from human to human. And that's not really what we see with, say, bird flu at this time. It really, it takes people direct contact with sick birds. And for Ebola, what we see is it really takes direct contact of people with sick people while they're very sick.
For the one of the physicians who was working with Ebola patients got the virus. Why did they take him to the University of Nebraska to recover?
You know, that's there's a, big questions about that. And there are four areas, four places in the United States that are sort of set up, not necessarily for Ebola, but for managing pathogens of high consequence, whatever it may be. One of them is in Atlanta. I think we've heard most of it. And when I used to work at CDC, this, I mean, memory was across the street. And so that makes a lot of sense. Another one is in Nebraska. One of them is in Montana, and the other in Maryland.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about that, though, the doctor that was in Atlanta and recovered then donated some blood this week for the doctor that it was in Omaha trying to, you know, being treated. Because they're thinking maybe he has developed some sort of antibodies that his blood could deliver to that other doctor. And I thought, well, that sounds like a movie script right there.
We're hearing about it new, but the first Ebola outbreak, it came in September 1976 in what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo. From that outbreak, actually, similar things happened. There were, sure, 90% of the people had died, but from those 10%, they were able to get the antibodies and actually give it successfully to a laboratory worker who got infected. And so the history of these antibodies from sick people who recover, actually being able to help somebody who is acutely ill, that's, so we have about 40 years of experience with that.
And isn't that part of the problem, the bigger problem in Africa, is that in this country, we have a much better system to handle something like Ebola than in that country. When you see some of that footage, there's card tables under a tent, and they're saying probably the best thing to do if you get Ebola there is to not go seek medical help. That's interesting advice.
It is it is interesting advice. Let me take a few steps backwards from that. These outbreaks such as Ebola are really markers of poor healthcare infrastructure and public health infrastructure. These, if you think about how Ebola is spread, and this is direct contact with stool or blood or vomit from people who are acutely sick. You know, it's not that they're walking around. And in these areas, in, say, West Africa, developing countries, it's mostly their family members who are taking care of them while they're sick. And so they get exposed. And because they don't have sort of the public health infrastructure, and if you don't have a toilet, right, then you're not going to be really able to take care of these infectious body fluids. And take that to the United States. Well, if somebody is sick, well, we put them in the hospital. And so this community infections just wouldn't happen. And unfortunately, the idea of this advice of people in West Africa who are infected not seeking medical care has hampered the efforts of public health to contain this. And the things that have contained Ebola outbreaks for the last 40 years and tried and true are just basic epidemiology. Find the people who are infected, make sure they're in isolation. Find the people who they've been in contact with and make sure they're in quarantine to make sure that they don't get infected. And trying to resurrect basic public health infrastructure and hand hygiene and things like that. And
The sociological parts of it are the interesting parts. I mean, I saw that footage of the man who was infected that was walking through a market, and people were like, "That guy has it," and they were basically tackling him and dragging him into an ambulance because he said, "I don't want to go to the hospital." I mean, the impact of the psychology of it is interesting too.
Right, and there's things that we take for granted in the West, as far as we trust our government officials. And when they come knocking on your door And they're saying, you know, we for your health and the health of the public, please do these things. And we, you know, this is something that we naturally will agree
to. In general.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, put yourself in war-torn areas of Africa, and you know, there is not that implicit trust in government officials, and so, and also not the level of healthcare literacy that we have here. And so when you start, when people are coming and when they say what they see is their health, their loved ones being taken away to hospitals and coming back in body bags. And so the assumption is that it is that they are getting sick and dying in the hospital. So then they don't tell people when they come knocking, is there anyone who's been exposed?
Yeah,
they
you're
say
not gonna
no.
Say, you're not going
right.
to say, sure.
Right, exactly.
So this is a virus, and like most viruses, there's really not any treatment. So the treatment is really supportive until the body's own, patient's own immune system can kill off the virus, right?
That's exactly right. And there's been a lot of news about some of these newer drugs that are being developed. And there's right now nothing that has nothing been licensed, and we don't, really don't have any strong trials that have actually been conducted on any of these new treatments. And I think we, exactly as you said, try to shift the attention from these new things to the basic epidemiology that has actually been shown to work. And when people are sick, it's basic supportive care. Basic for us in the West,
sure.
But trying to do the supportive care that you need to adequately take care of a patient with Ebola in rural West Africa is very difficult.
What about a vaccine? Will that soon be available, do you
think?
So
there are several vaccines that are in development, and including, I think that in the fall, there will be a trial of this coming up.
All right, well, that'll be good. And then we'll all get vaccinated and wipe this thing out, huh? You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest and expert in infectious disease is Dr. Pratish Tosh.
Coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams. Plus, we'll take your phone calls at 507-282-1234. Or you can tweet us with your questions at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Here's news about a connection between diabetes and inflammation. Spanish researchers have found that inflammation may be why high blood sugar levels damage your blood vessels. This raises the possibility that anti-inflammatory medications may one day be used to lower the risk of blood vessel disease in people with diabetes. Now, this is according to a new study presented at the American Heart Association's High Blood Pressure Research Scientific Sessions 2014. Researchers there say these findings may explain why controlling blood sugar alone is not enough to prevent cardiovascular diseases in people with diabetes. They say new medications to reduce inflammation are what's needed, and they say lifestyle changes such as exercise and weight control are important because they reduce blood sugar and they reduce inflammation. And in other news, information about kidney cancer. Needle-guided tumor destruction procedures offer near-equivalent lengths of local cancer control compared to surgery for patients with small kidney cancer tumors. This is according to a Mayo Clinic study published in the journal European Urology. Here's Dr. R. Houston Thompson.
The patient is put to sleep. A needle is inserted through the back towards the kidney and guided under imaging into the tumor. Multiple needles are then directed. A biopsy is taken, and then the tumor is either frozen with an ice ball around the tumor, or it is cooked with radiofrequency ablation, both causing tumor destruction. There are some advantages in that an ablation procedure is a little bit less invasive. Hospital stay is generally less, on average one night, as opposed to a couple nights for surgical removal of the tumor.
And in other news, let's talk about risk-taking behavior. A study from the University of British Columbia reports making decisions in a high-stakes situation, such as whether to steal a base in baseball or place a bet, may be influenced by a chemical in the brain. They say it's the rise and fall of dopamine that influences decisions that involve risk and reward. Now, apparently, dopamine levels rise when the risk pays off. The researchers tested decision-making of rats. If they pressed one lever, they got a small reward. But if they pressed another one, they got either a big reward or nothing. The more dopamine signals firing in the rat's brains, the riskier their choices became. They say this shows how important those signals are to decision making, and these findings can provide insight into what happens when these signals don't work normally, as may happen in some mental illnesses. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Dr. Tom Shives, along with Tracy McRae. Information you want from specialists who know you are listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on air, online, and also on iHeartRadio. And by the way, if you want to listen live on your smartphone, you just go to KROCAM.com.
That's where we're at.
That's right. And push listen live, and you can hear us anywhere you are.
It's time for you to join our conversation. You can contact us by phone at 507-282-1234, or you can tweet us at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
Today's topic, infectious diseases, with Dr. Pratish Tosh. Anything you'd like to ask about the virus or bacteria, or share a story about an infection you've had? So you having a little trouble with your headphones over there?
There we go.
I fixed it for you.
Now I'm back. Thank you.
Oh, I was afraid I was going to have to answer those questions.
Now listen, we were talking so much about Ebola before that we didn't even get to our myth or matter of fact question, which is the Ebola virus is more dangerous than influenza. And there is so much discussion on Facebook and on Twitter about this. And you said both answers are kind of true.
That's right. And so it depends.
Right. It depends.
It's if you are infected with Ebola, and right now in this outbreak, we're seeing 55% of the people are dying. Now, mind you, that's in the setting of West African healthcare, but it is an aggressive infection. And so, if I were to have a choice between being infected with Ebola and being infected with influenza every day, I would pick influenza. But then you look at it in terms of the global risk, and we know, even just in the United States, with seasonal influenza every year, we have tens of thousands of people in the United States dying. And multiply that across the world. And then we look at pandemics of new infections, of novel pathogens. And I get really concerned about the next influenza pandemic. And so in a global sense, I'm more concerned about influenza. But on the patient-to-patient sense, I think that Ebola would be more dangerous.
Sure.
Well, isn't it part of it is the Ebola, there's no human-to-human transmission. But with influenza, there is?
There is human-to-human transmission with Ebola, but it's not respiratory spread.
Right.
Right? And so it really, for Ebola, you really need direct contact with somebody who's really, really sick. Influenza, I mean, if you're in nearby somebody who's been coughing, or sometimes influenza can be infectious before they're symptomatic.
Yeah.
And so that's why in 2009, we saw the influenza pandemic go across the world in a matter of a week.
Helen has a question for us. Let's go to the phones, 507-282-1234. Good morning, Helen. Go right ahead with your question.
I'm wondering, how does the virus or infection like this get started, and how come we've never heard about Ebola before?
Very good question.
That is a fantastic question. And in some ways, it looks at the animal reservoir, and that anytime we have a new bug, these are often coming from the animals, and that if a bacteria or a virus is infecting humans for long enough, it really tries to adapt to humans and not cause too much damage. But these really aggressive bugs, the Middle East respiratory syndrome, we saw in the spring, and then and Ebola, these are often coming from animal reservoirs. And right now for Ebola, it seems to be likely bats transmitted to non-human primates like monkeys. And anytime you have more human-animal interface, such as with the bushmeat trade in West Africa, where people will, say, on the black market, buy a monkey that's for food, then you start to really get this interaction between animals and humans, and start to get these infections from the animal reservoir into humans.
We're not certain where the Ebola came from, but probably an animal, a chimpanzee or a...
Right, right. It's certainly a zoonosis, meaning it's certainly an animal reservoir for the virus. And Most science right now is pointing to it being the fruit bat as the natural reservoir, although that's not conclusive.
Because they don't get immunizations. They don't have their health care like they should.
Right, right.
You know, quite a few of the comments that we had on Facebook and on Twitter have to do with something about a genetic mutation that Ebola, you know, it mutates, then that's what makes it hard to track down. When it comes to something like that or RSV or even the flu, you know, we hear... that here's the flu that we're vaccinating against this season, and you predict that from last season. I mean, so there's always the mutation aspect of it. Isn't that right?
Right, and especially when we're looking at respiratory viruses, respiratory syncytial virus, which is RSV, and influenza, especially with influenza, every season, in fact, every time it goes from one person to another, there's minor changes. And we can anticipate what the next year's strain is going to look like based on what we've been seeing and the strains that we've collected. It's a little bit of an art, and we have sort of the brightest minds in the world who are working on that to really predict what is likely going to be coming up. But, you know, sometimes that match is not as good as we'd like.
Infectious disease specialist Dr. Pratish Tasha, our phone lines are open, 507-282-1234. So, let's talk a little bit about the enterovirus 68,
sure.
And that just sort of came out of the blue, but I understand this is not the first outbreak of this virus.
No, this is, I think we've started detecting this particular strain since the 1960s, and enteroviruses cause a large number of different kinds of infections. The ones we get most concerned about are actually viral meningitis, but enteroviruses can also cause the common cold, this particular strain causes these respiratory infections like the common cold, but seems to be a little bit more aggressive than most of the other enterovirus strains.
But why in kids and not in the adults that live with the kids? Why just the kids?
Yeah. And so the longer you're alive, the more likely you've been exposed to different types of enteroviruses and different kinds of cold viruses and likely to have immunity. And so we're seeing this in kids because they probably haven't been exposed to it. And the things that are coming up in most of these kids that have been infected and are hospitalized, that most of them has some sort of respiratory illness to begin with, for example, asthma, that put them at higher risk of getting complications if they were to get a respiratory infection.
Now we're getting down to it, because there are people who are saying, this is why you got to let kids be dirty and play in the mud and not use hand sanitizer. And so what if they don't wash their hands all the time? They got to catch these bugs so that they develop an immunity and we stop having kids that get so sick when the littlest virus comes through.
And there's a sort of a yin and yang with that. And a part of my interest is also with making sure that we're actually spreading enough normal bugs between people,
right,
and that maybe we are too clean. And some of these things of being too clean and not being sort of exchanging our normal bacteria might be leading to all kinds of different problems, including allergies and obesity, and who knows. On the other hand, we do know that hand hygiene and covering your nose and mouth when you sneeze or cough does prevent the transmission of infection. And so I think when it comes down to it, is if somebody's sick, less touching is better. But if you're healthy, there's some room for exchange of bacteria, if you will.
What about I was just going to say that hand sanitizer, it always says on there, kills 99.9% of whatever. It's that little point, tenth of a point that get through. That's what keeps the situation going.
Well, it's that 99.9. You're never going to sterilize the human body and without putting it in an autoclave or something.
But it seems like people are moving away from use this hand sanitizer. Don't use it as much. I mean, in parents' magazines, I think the message you're getting now is don't use this on your kids as much.
You know, I'm not a pediatrician, so I won't be able to comment on that. I can say that we do know that the use of hand sanitizer does prevent transmission of infection.
All right.
And if somebody is sick, or you're near somebody who is sick, or in a situation where you just went to a petting zoo or something like that, keeping your hands clean
is important,
in part because me right now, I'm just touching my face.
Mm-hmm.
And
radio stations are not the cleanest places, so just make sure.
Good to know.
That's why we don't get sicker. We're exposed to all these germs.
True.
You got to eat a little dirt when you're a kid. That's the bottom line, isn't it?
I'll pass it along to my niece and nephew.
Yeah, 507-282-1234 is our telephone number. I want to ask you next about resistant germs,
yeah.
because that, I think, is worrisome to a lot of us who work in a hospital setting, that the antibiotics that we have now sometimes will not kill the germs that we're seeing. And MRSA is a big deal now in the hospital where it's supposed to be so clean.
Absolutely. And this comes to a bit of evolution and ecology. That we think that humans, that we invented penicillin in the 1930s, 1940s, but in fact, penicillin we derived from a fungus, Penicillium, that has been fighting Staph aureus, the SA and MRSA, for millennia, before humans were thinking about coming down from the trees. And so Staph aureus had actually developed resistance long time before we showed up.
Really?
And what we did by using penicillin is sort of select out for those Staph aureus that were already resistant. And if the analogy that I use is between the Serengeti and the Great Plains of the United States. And if you can imagine a zebra being just a resistant bug, a resistant horse, if you were to take two zebras from the Serengeti and drop them down to the Great Plains of the United States, well, you have normal horses running around and wolves and what have you, and those two zebras are not going to survive very long because they're not supposed to. They're not well adapted. But then you get rid of the normal horses through, say, antibiotics, or get rid of the normal wolves, and you set up a situation where something that really should not be surviving very well can survive. And you put into those two zebras the Great Plains of the United States, and suddenly you have zebras everywhere. And that is the concern. The more antibiotics you give, you're really clearing out the normal things that are supposed to be, the normal microbiota, and leaving away for this bacteria that has all this sort of extra baggage in terms of resistance mechanisms that shouldn't survive in a normal setting that can survive and proliferate.
And humans haven't adapted to that bacteria yet.
Well, it's more so that you have all these friendly bacteria that take up a lot of, that we used to think they were just taking up space in our gut. Turns out that they're really, really important just in our normal development and keeping away these bacteria, these pathogens that really don't belong.
What about, I was wanting to ask about antibiotics.
Yeah.
Why do we need to take all of our antibiotics?
Yeah. If you are sick, and there, we do know that if you stop the antibiotics too quickly, if you have a bacterial infection, even if you're feeling better, that some of that bacteria may still be there. And so it's important to finish that course of antibiotics to make sure that that infection has gone.
And so, but the second part is, why do we not need to not take so many antibiotics?
Right. Unfortunately, on the other part of that is that there's a lot of antibiotic use that is unnecessary, meaning that people are getting antibiotics for viral infections or some infections that they would normally get better on their own. And so by taking unnecessary antibiotics, we are contributing overall to the increase in the resistance, but also within the human, within that person itself, clearing out the normal bacteria and making way, clearing out the Great Plains and letting the two zebras run wild.
You know, it's interesting, isn't it, that the surveys show that about 40% of people who go to the doctor with a common cold end up getting an antibiotic. But part of it is the mothers and the fathers, they want their kid to have an antibiotic because they think it'll help, even though it won't. And the same is true for ear infections. We've now realized that the majority of ear infections are caused by a virus, not by a bacteria. Why do you think this happens? And what's the answer?
Yeah, I mean, it's we can think of it on a sort of a grand scale that, yeah, we need to reduce our antibiotic use. But when you are there with a mother who's trying to take care of their
sick
crying
kid.
Sick kid.
Don't give other people's kids the antibiotics, but give mine.
Exactly. Right. And that it's part of it is the expectations that they've been dealing with this, and there must be something that they can be given. And it's also difficult to prove that they don't have a bacterial infection.
Yep.
And so because of the interaction between, say, parents or a patient and their physician, it takes a lot of explaining. And sort of talking about some of the side effects and some of the problems with antibiotics. And so I can understand where it's really difficult for physicians to say no.
Yeah, that's right. It takes you 30 seconds to write out the prescription. It takes you 5 minutes to explain why you're not going to give them a prescription.
That's exactly right.
One of the things I have to mention is the epidemic of fear.
Yes.
Because I think part of that's what made the Ebola story so fantastic. It was August. There's really nothing else for people to talk about in the media. And the epidemic of fear is different than a real epidemic.
Right. And so I don't want to downplay the actual epidemic that's going on in West Africa, because that is real. And we have, you know, over 2,000 people who have died, and there's probably going to be several more that will die by the time this is over. But then there's a lot of the things that came up in the media. I am glad that people were talking about it in the media and that we were able to put attention to what needs to happen in West Africa, because this has been a real problem. But part of that that got translated is that there's a risk, a major risk to the United States. And as Ed mentioned, because we have this very robust public health infrastructure and healthcare infrastructure in the United States, the chances that we would have a community outbreak of Ebola extending into the community of the United States is you know, vanishingly small. Of course, we have to be ready as hospitals for in case somebody were to come in on a plane that we're able to take care of them. But there's this balance of people being afraid here, even though the risk is very low, and having enough sort of putting enough interest for so people know about what's going on in West Africa and can do something about it.
All right, we've got a couple of minutes remaining. Should we talk to Paul?
Okay, 282-1234. Paul, go right ahead with your question.
Yes, I have a question for the doctor. I guess I haven't quite formed the question yet, but we are required, when we send our children to school, to get a whole series of injections, and a lot of people are rejecting, not getting that particular injection of the virus or whatever it is. Now, how does that differ from getting an antivirus or an injection for Ebola or MERS or whatever happens to be, you know?
Okay.
All right, Paul.
Sure. I mean, there's been some controversy. Some controversy, not of science, but controversy within the public about the possible negative impacts of vaccines. And this has been studied extensively. And we do know that for all of the recommended vaccines, these are amazingly safe. And they do not result in things like autism and things like that. And this has been studied extensively.
And in fact, some childhood diseases are coming back because they are not getting their vaccinations.
Right. And so when my time was in the Epidemic Intelligence Service and CDC, there were several outbreaks of measles and things like that. And so the decrease in vaccination has certainly contributed to that. It's a real problem.
Infectious disease specialist Dr. Pratish Tosh. Dr. Tosh, thanks so much. I guess the bottom line on Ebola is, fortunately, it's fairly well confined so far. It has not spread to the United States, and there may soon be a vaccine for it.
I certainly hope it's effective, and say hopefully we'll be able to tackle this outbreak in West Africa.
Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk suicide awareness with Mayo psychiatrist Dr. Maren Veldick. You know, the World Health Organization just released some rather startling and actually disturbing statistics. They said that every 40 seconds, someplace in the world, someone takes their own life. More than 800,000 suicides per year worldwide. And it is truly a major, but I think in the main, it is a preventable health issue. And it's not that easy to talk about.
No, just this past week was World Suicide Awareness Day. And indeed, this will only be our second program that this show has ever tackled on the topic, because it's something that people don't want to talk about. It makes them uncomfortable, maybe reminds them of someone that they lost and some pain that they went through. But indeed, talking about it is what's going to turn it around.
Exactly. As we mentioned, it is potentially preventable. And one question that we'll ask him is suicide more common than it used to be? And if so, why? Suicide awareness next week on Mayo Clinic Radio.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program as well as previous episodes. Or you can visit us at mayoclinic.org, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic share their expertise to help you better manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer, Embrace Ryan, our technical director, Kim David. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray. I was going to say Dr. Tosh. There we go.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.